table outside with some friends. We were out in the small group discussion portion of a class in a nice, sunny, warm courtyard. And just as we stood up from the table to return to our classroom, one of my friends said, "Look, a rainbow." And I was immediately caught with a sense of joy that I get to see something beautiful out here in the sun before returning to my classroom for another hour and a half. And so I looked into the sky, and I looked into the sky, and all I could see was blue. Now, I know where to look for rainbows. They arc down through the sky, then disappear behind a hill or some trees. They come where the rain meets the sun. But as much as I looked, I didn't see a thing. After just a few seconds of looking fruitlessly, actually, my perplexity shifted towards having a sense of anxiety at my inability to find the rainbow. And I could also feel a small thread of frustrated anger, as though my friend next to me had betrayed me with a trick. I was just about to ask him what exactly he thought he was talking about, when suddenly I saw it. Not arcing down through the sky, but filling wholly this one solitary cloud right in the center of the sky, all through it. I had never imagined such a thing before. In the parable of the talents, Jesus points and says, "Look, the kingdom of heaven is like this. But where is the kingdom of heaven hiding in the story of the master and three slaves?" What are we being asked to imagine? Liz helpfully described last week that the Jewish community which recorded this version of Jesus' good news, the Matthean community, was living in a tough situation. They were striving for self-definition and survival in the unstable political and religious climate following the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. How were they to be followers of the God of Israel in light of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, when not all of the Jews wanted to follow Jesus, and many around them had no interest in the God of Israel at all? What were they to do with what they had been given? Christians have had to ask this question for 2,000 years with only shades of difference. How are we to follow Christ when this neighbor wants to go with us on that journey? And this neighbor is ambivalent or even hostile to the way of Jesus. What are we to do with what we have been given? I feel this keenly in my own walk. As I anticipate returning to the Episcopal Church in New Hampshire with the hope of leading as a priest, I have asked, what will my role be? Will there be any job for me? And especially, am I equal to the task? I know from conversation with many of you that the different forms of these questions are familiar to many or all of us. During the recent election competition, we've asked what our role in this democratic process is and how a disciple of Jesus should make political choices. In the midst of growing as families, we've asked how our whole family shares together in the life of the church. In the midst of growing and learning as individuals, we continually ask, what next? What is God's hope for my life? And especially, am I equal to the task? This last question is the one I hear Jesus addressing today for the Matthean community and for all Christians. Are we equal to the task? I'm going to just note here that the language of slave and master, which rightfully may be troubling to us, comes from a very different social system. And in order to honor the need to wrestle with that, I'm going to use the language of the parable of slave and master. But you might also consider hearing that word slave as worker in the context that it's coming from. A man was about about to go on a journey, and he entrusted his slave with his property, and each received talents according to his ability. Our common usage of the word talent in English speaks to the prevailing interpretation of this parable. A talent was something like the storytelling equivalent of $1 million in Jesus' day. But in the parable, it stands for the abilities given to each disciple. Like the lamps and their wicks given to each bridesmaid in last week's parable, each slave here is given something to tend. Immediately, we are told, each slave worked with what he or she had been given. And focusing on this immediately can help us to avoid two red herrings in the passage which might otherwise distract us: the amount given and the amount of increase yielded to each slave in their work. When the master returns, we read that he calls each amount little, whether it's 5 talents or 2 or 1. And so we see that the increase and the disposition of the worker are much more important than the initial amount. And in terms of the amount of increase, we can also read the alternate version in Luke's gospel, where the first and second slave actually produce different multiples of increase, but both are seen as faithful. And so, again, the disposition of the worker is where Jesus' focus is strongest here. In time, the master returns and settles accounts with the slaves. The first and the second come forward and frame their offering this way: "Master, here is what you have given me, and here is the fruit of my labors with it." They're commended for being good and trustworthy, or what could be translated good and faithful. Then the third comes forward and begins, unlike the other two, not with a statement of what talents he or she was entrusted with, but with a statement of apparent justification for burying the talent. And this justification is based on the assumed nature of the master. The third slave is then condemned as evil and lazy and thrown into Matthew's thematic outer darkness, where there will be weeping and the grinding of teeth. Like the story of the wise and the foolish bridesmaids last week, this story of the trustworthy and lazy slaves cannot, within the whole arc of Jesus' teaching, be taken as a condemnation upon those who struggle or are lost. Jesus always seeks the lost. But this parable is for those who have been found and yet are asking, "Am I equal to the task?" In this light, we are admonished to focus upon the character of each of the slaves' faithfulness or lack thereof, and to see these as lenses for our own faithfulness as disciples. It's from this perspective that the seemingly strange words of verse 29 become illuminating rather than obscuring. "For to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away." Clearly, like the bridesmaids, each slave has in fact been entrusted with something. None actually have nothing, for even the lazy slave has something to be taken away from them. And yet, somehow, functionally, they live in nothingness. This is because, finally, having in this parable, in both of these parables, is equivalent with seeing. Seeing what is before you, what is in your hands, what is in your very self. The third slave acts from fear and therefore sees nothing, even in what is. The first and second turn immediately to the works possible with their talents, and therefore create and are given even more. Again, the word "immediately" gives insight, because we've heard it elsewhere in Matthew. As in, "Immediately they left their nets and followed Jesus," and "Immediately his leprosy was cleansed," and "Moved with compassion, Jesus touched their eyes, regained their sight and followed him. In each of these cases, immediately, which seems to happen in a moment, is shown to be a symbol of what has been taking place in a long life of faithfulness, of readiness to work with what is given. Paul says in the letter to the Thessalonians, "For you are all children of light and children of the day. By the light of Christ, who walked among us, we learn to ask the right questions, to learn to see what is there to be worked with." We ask the question then, not are we equal to the task before us, but how, in what way are we equal to the task before us? Without a guide, I never would have found the rainbow in the cloud. Even with a guide, I still had to wrestle, albeit momentarily, with a sense of my own incompetence and with unkind feelings toward that guide who was trying to help me. But when I found the rainbow, not only did I see something beautiful, I was taught a new way of seeing. See what I had not expected before. What we need for faithful living has been entrusted to us, and we're invited to see it. And this isn't a trite idea for the powerful or the privileged. It's a truth embraced by the struggling Methian community and by Christians throughout diverse times and places. It's God's promise, and it is challenging. Within this community, this continuing body of Christ, we must individually lift our eyes and look for the talents in each other. When the ancient Israelites cried out to God, they then looked up and they found in the life of Deborah the talents for that moment. We heard in the song, crying out to God, and it involved a lifting up of their eyes. In this moment, as we lift our eyes to our gathered community, whose talents do we need to turn to now? Which of us needs to step up and offer our talents? It's in this offering that we have found and continue to find the ways to live forward through political seasons and through growing as families and through our seemingly individual trials. God's promise, which I was reminded of by the rainbow in the cloud, which Noah was reminded of by a perhaps more conventional rainbow, which we see in the life of Deborah, and which we know through the incarnation of Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus, is that what we need is here, if we will see it.